The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network. Want to fearlessly explore your creative spirit? Join artist Susie K. Edwards for Path of the Butterfly, a weekend workshop at Omega Institute's beautiful campus in Rhinebeck, New York, May 24th through 26. Experiment with a variety of art forms, engage in mindfulness, walking, and silent meditation, and discover a new and free-flowing creative vision. This workshop is for beginners and professional artists. Learn more at eomega.org/thrive.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Support for this show is brought to you by Tarcher Peregrine, publisher of Life Lessons, the new book of affirmations by Julia Cameron, the best-selling author of The Artist's Way. Buy Life Lessons wherever books are sold.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, this is Essential Conversations. Our guest today is Mariano Sigman. He's the author of The Secret Life of the Mind, How Your Brain Thinks, Feels, and Decides. Dr. Sigman is a physicist by training and a leading international figure in the cognitive neuroscience field, and he is a leader in the study of learning and decision making. He is the founder of the Integrative Neuroscience Laboratory at the University of Buenos Aires and a director of the Human Brain Project. A review of Secret Life of the Mind appears in the July-August issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Mariano Sigman, welcome to Essential Conversations.
Thank you so much.
So I have the book in front of me. I went through the book. And the only thing that you and I have in common is we both have a brain. Other than that, I don't. The book was like, wow, there is so much more to my, at least to your brain than mine. That's for sure. So I really want to jump right into this and ask you to keep this as close to the ground as possible, because I will get lost. And I want to start.
That's what I'd like to do.
I want to start with just the title. So The Secret Life of the Mind, and then the subtitle is How Your Brain Thinks, Feels, and Decides. Is there a difference in your mind between the mind and the brain?
Well, I mean, this we could spend the entire 20 minutes on this. I mean, humanity, philosophers have spent years and years and centuries on this question, on the mind-brain issue. I'm a neuroscientist, but I think that the majority of us actually are not so concerned about the biology of the brain, how it's made of neurons and synapses and how they wire to each other, but the result of all this process in terms of what we feel, what we think, how we love, how we decide, and so on. And that's what we intuitively refer as the mind. It's the collective mental experiences that we do have. And of course, as a neuroscientist, I think that there is a direct link between brain activity, what happens in the brain, and what we experience in our own minds. But of course, those are different levels of descriptions. We can study the mind without digging within the brain, and can study the brain forgetting about the mind. I'm somehow interested in the connection between these things, how what goes on in our brains then has to do with what we experience in our own minds.
So am I on track if I suggest that the mind is an emergent property of the brain? The brain reaches a certain level of complexity.
Yeah, this would be a succinct way. The mind, historically, we've known that the mind has something to do with the brain, although it's also been linked to the heart, and now we think that it's related to all what goes on in our body and physiological experiences. So yeah, I think that a good way to put that up would be to say that essentially in the last 20 or 30 years, our investigation of the mind has changed completely because now we have the ability to look within the brain, which before we couldn't do. So it's a bit like humanity has looked at the sky for centuries, but then we had a telescope, and then we could see things that were invisible before that. And now somehow we can dig into the human brain in real time and seeing how this very complex pattern of neural activity, like a symphony of neurons that are playing different tunes, actually do relate to the experiences that we have. How the brain organizes when we make risky decisions, how the brain organizes when we are lying, how the brain organizes when we feel nervous or when we feel anxious. And this has given us, I think, a different level of understanding of ourselves, of our own introspection, of our own minds.
You know, in the book you write, it's a short quote, because you say, the brain is capable of observing and monitoring its own processes in order to control them, inhibit them, shape them, halt them, or simply manage them. Why do you think anything more than that is necessary? You know, why is self-awareness evolutionary? Why is that a benefit? Why, you know, if the brain can monitor all these things, why does it need me?
Yeah, well, it doesn't, I think. And essentially we could function equally. I think this is one of the hardest questions. In evolution, there are many things that appear in or have evolved throughout the course of evolution that are not needed. So evolution is, of course, not a perfect machinery that develops all pieces that are strictly needed for things. So some are epiphenomenons of other things. So one thing that's needed within the brain and that has given, I think, human behavior a huge advantage is this ability that we have to observe ourselves. Not all animals do that. And this has to do with, I think, that there are two clear moments of our experiences where this is quite clear. One is dreaming. During dreaming, essentially, we are playing our own reality, but it's detached from real experience. So it's a bit, and the other situation is play, when we are just role playing or simulating or thinking how it would be if we would do that or the other thing. So this ability that we have to somehow detach from the present and simulate our own experience in dreams, in narratives, in fiction, in play, is something which is quite human, not exclusively human, but quite human. And I think, and many scientists would agree that it's very much related to what we perceive as consciousness. It's a brain that somehow can simulate itself just to be able to live experiences in fiction that are somehow unrelated from a concrete, real, everyday experience. But this said, I think that, I mean, this is only a partial answer to your question, because the hard question which you ask is, we could do all that without having the experience of the self, without having the sense of consciousness. And I think this is true. Many neuroscientists, and I include within them, think that in a way consciousness is a sort of illusion. It's an epiphenomenon of a process of the brain being able to observe itself that then has led to what we now feel and experience as consciousness. And it may also be true, and this is something that's also changed quite a lot during the last years in the way we think consciousness, that the way we think of consciousness has not always, it's not essentially a virtue of human thought, that consciousness may have changed a lot throughout different cultures and throughout the way we experience our self-consciousness throughout our development and even throughout different moments of our lives. We've all had moments in which we have, because of very stressful experience or during a high fever confusion, or people that go through experience with drugs or different ways in which people have experienced very, very different forms of consciousness. So maybe consciousness is not as a strong construct as we think in this moment of our societies.
How do you, I've read a lot of neuroscientists who deal with this issue of consciousness from maybe the point of view of meditation practice. And you know, I mean, I can become aware through different meditation practices or even just sitting and talking with you. I'm aware of my mind or my brain. Let's not do mind. Let's say I'm aware of my brain thinking all kinds of things that are completely irrelevant to the conversation you and I are having, triggered by what's going on, you know, around me, looking out my window, seeing different things. And I'm aware of those thoughts. But the thoughts just seem to happen. Emotions just seem to happen. I mean, it seems like my brain thinks the way an ocean waves or the way the wind blows or the sun shines. It's just something that it does. And yet, as you were saying just a moment ago, I can observe it. And I'm wondering if you have this is my theory, and I'm going to ask you to just comment on it. I wonder if that sense of disconnect, I'm not saying it's real, but it feels real, that I can observe my own thoughts gives rise to the notion that there's a non-material me, a soul, if you want, or spirit, or something that is beyond the brain, that can observe the brain, and observe what the brain is doing, but that doesn't need the brain. And if the brain dies or when the brain dies, that observer me can survive physical death. I'm not asking you if you believe that. I'm asking you if you think that's where that idea of surviving death might come from.
Want to fearlessly explore your creative spirit? Join artist Susie K. Edwards for Path of the Butterfly, a weekend workshop at Omega Institute's beautiful campus in Rhinebeck, New York, May 24th through 26. Experiment with a variety of art forms, engage in mindfulness, walking, and silent meditation, and discover a new and free-flowing creative vision. This workshop is for beginners and professional artists. Learn more at eomega.org/thrive.
Yeah, well, It's many questions in one. I think first the idea that the brain is constantly producing thoughts and imagery and fiction and narrative, and I think this is very essential to the way we understand the brain. So the brain is not just a passive machine that's or a passive organ that's somehow reacting to the environment. It's constructing its own reality, and this is, I think, very, and again we can come back to the idea of dreams, which is an exaggeration of that, where you just, you know, you close your eyes and you go for what seems to be a rest, and then the brain starts producing thoughts, as it's an ocean that's moving and producing its own patterns. Now, when typically we alternate between, in as you were saying, during a conversation, the brain is moving on and off from external stimuli, from now what you're hearing and what I'm saying and what you're listening or what you're seeing, and its own creations, and somehow these things are fused in a cohesive reality. This is not always true, again. So, for instance, one idea which I go through in the book, and which I also sketched in a TED talk which I gave, is that when this breaks down. So when people start producing these voices, but they do not recognize that they're producing these voices, then the most likely interpretation is that these voices are just coming from the muses or from the gods or from creations. And this is a bit what today we would recognize as schizophrenia. So what I'm trying to present here, which I think it's quite a different idea, is that when people think of schizophrenia, they think, well, they're making all sorts of hallucinations and weird mental creations. What I'm trying to say now is that we all make these mental creations. The difference we have, or the majority of normal people have with schizophrenics, is that they recognize that they're creating these their own thoughts. And so they don't seem that weird, and they can control it, and they can somehow mold them and fuse them with the reality that they're living. So I think that we need to find this equilibrium between the mental creations and productions that the brain is constantly making. It's the brain is a machine that never halts. You know, our computers, we turn them off and then they're off for like 2 days and then on back again. The brain never stops, not during sleep, not during, I mean, it's constantly making productions, and these productions have to do with the experience that we reconstruct. How this relates to death, I really don't know. I think that this is It's something that I think I don't have a good explanation on how this relates to our experience of feeling alive and or not, or the feeling of death that I don't know.
Okay. And I wasn't asking you what happens when we die. I'm just listening to you and reading the book. I got the sense that it's natural for us to feel some kind of internal alienation or separation, because I can watch my brain at work. And we take that watcher so literally that we imagine it is unattached to the body.
And the question is who's watching and where is the thing being watched? For one thing, we perceive our thoughts as being in our heads, and our thoughts are not in our heads. I mean, our brain is in our head, but our thoughts, whatever they are, I mean, they could be elsewhere. And often, I mean, there's an interesting, many of these things become interesting when the mind goes on weird corners. And an interesting one is what's called out-of-body experiences.
Right.
And I think this goes very straight on what you're saying. This is an experience that some people do feel normally, and it's induced, again, often by strong psychedelic drugs, which is that people do observe themselves outside of, from a perspective which is outside of their bodies. And so the two pieces that you're saying, the I observing and the I being observed, which of course normally is the same I that fuses in one, actually decouple completely in this again, weird reconstruction of consciousness.
Now, I think that may be, have a lot to do with where religion comes from, because I think people see that as this, they take it as a actual phenomenon. Well, it is a phenomenon, but they take it as a reality beyond, beyond the natural, that it's somehow a supernatural thing. You know, earlier it's actually right in the title of the book, How Your Brain Thinks, Feels, and Decides is the subtitle. The title is The Secret Life of the Mind. I just want to talk a little bit about decision-making. Because in the book, you make a big deal out of the unconscious. You talk about the study that shows that the brain seems to decide things before my conscious mind is aware of it. You know, if I'm going to lift my right arm, it seems that my right arm, my brain knew I was going to do it before I actually did it, and then decided, and then told myself a story about, oh, I lifted it for a reason. Do you have a sense, or what's your personal sense of free will?
I think, I think my own take, and I don't have a huge confidence on that. It's not, but is that there's no free will in the sense that we think that there's free will, but we should act as if there would be free will. Because this is acting in the moment that you accept. So If you take the premise from physicists that life is made of matter, and eventually this matter becomes very complicated and gets on very weird thermodynamic states that actually are autocatalytic and so on, and you have life from there on and simple life and things that years and centuries ago would seem very complicated, like creating life from matter, now are possible. I wouldn't think that it's completely impossible that we could play with matter on a way that we can reconstruct something which is as sophisticated as we are. Actually, we are now building intelligences that are somehow as sophisticated as ourselves. So I do not see a conflict between a deterministic interpretation of matter and what we are. And of course, this raises a big issue because we all have a strong illusion that we are the responsibles and we are the authors of our own decisions. And so I think somehow that we do not need, at least for the science that we are creating, to call for a different sort of particle than the particles of matter that we have today. Now, this is one path of reflection. If you go very straight on that, then you go to a point which is, I think, very dangerous socially, because essentially you lose the notion of responsibility. When there's free will, you have an agent that potentially could choose different paths of action. If you think that everything has been written as a pinball of very complicated and sophisticated pinball on which all of our experiences are just an illusion, then there's essentially nothing that you can fight for or nothing that you can try to change throughout your life experience. And on a way, first, it's very sad because we just have very meaningless experiences. And second, I think that it leads to societies that are on a way much worse in essentially every single sense that we can think about our society. So again, short answer is maybe there is free will, but I think that for all what we know, the most likely interpretation is that free will is an illusion, but I think it's an illusion we should hold to. And if the science tells us that free will is an illusion, then that's doesn't mean at all, I think, that the reaction from that should be that then we should construct a society that tries to deny this illusion. The other way around, we should give credit to this illusion because it's, I think, it's a very healthy one for our social and spiritual and mental life.
Well, I tell you, Mariano, if I had free will, I would talk with you for another 20 minutes. But unfortunately, I don't. I am driven by the clock. So we are out of time. But this is, and I realize I asked huge questions and you did a great job trying to, you know, get to the heart of it. I really appreciate that very much.
Thank you very much. I love talking about these things. And of course, they're very complicated. And they're the questions that we'll try to answer for many more years and centuries, I guess. So those are, of course, only partial.
Answers, I mean,
we have fun answering them at least.
Well, I appreciate listening to you do it. Our guest today was Mariano Sigman. His new book, The Secret Life of the Mind, How Your Brain Thinks, Feels, and Decides, is reviewed in the July-August issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. You can learn more about his work at the Integrative Neuroscience Lab's website, neuro.org.ar. Mariano Sigman, thanks again for speaking with us on Essential Conversations.
Thank you so much.
Support for Essential Conversations is brought to you by Tarcher Peregrie, publisher of Life Lessons, the new book of affirmations by Julia Cameron, the best-selling author of The Artist's Way. You can buy Life Lessons wherever books are sold. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Please log in to spiritualityhealth.com to subscribe to the magazine in print or digital formats, and download the iTunes app for this podcast. Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator and executive producer is Al Matassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.
I'm Michelle Phillips, a celebrity makeup artist, beauty expert, self-confidence coach, and Hay House author. My podcast, Beauty and Beyond, is the place for women navigating the challenges of the aging process. Listen in for my professional advice, as well as my expert guests, as we share valuable tips, practical tools, and empowering resources to help you not only look amazing, but also live an amazing life. Part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network and available wherever you get your podcasts.